Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we've got FX's latest comic book adaptation, Legion, and the luscious follow-up to the nature documentary series, Planet Earth. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. But before we get started here in Substitute Historic Studio 46, let's go around the table.
I'm Stephen Thompson with NPR Music.
I'm Glenn Weldon. I write for the NPR website.
And in our fourth chair this week, oh, it's exciting. It's always exciting when we've got a brand new fourth chair. Straight from his job as a TV critic for Up Rocks and the author of The Revolution Was Televised and the co-author of TV The Book, Alan Sepinwall. Hey, Alan.
Hey, Linda. What's going on?
Well, not too much, but I thought maybe you wanted to do a little podcast with us. A lot of us wondered what Noah Hawley would do after he created the TV adaptation of Fargo and where we'd see Dan Stevens after he left Downton Abbey. One answer to both of those questions is Hawley's new show, Legion, in which Stevens plays a Marvel Comics character we find in a psychiatric hospital. Now, my first thought when we were going to talk about doing this show was to talk about it with Glenn, because Glenn talks a lot about, not only comics, but various comic adaptations. How did we've seen the first three of these. How did the first three of these strike you, Glenn?
I think that my reaction to the show is in direct proportion to how high my expectations were, because I love Noah Hawley.
Yeah.
And I love Fargo, particularly season two, which I thought was the best thing on television in 2015. I think it improved on season one of Fargo, and that was a tough thing to do because I loved that too.
Yeah.
Yes. Because what he did then was he entered a existing world, the world of the Coens Fargo, universe, and built off it. And, certainly had what he was doing informed by it. And he's doing kind of the same thing here. I went back and looked. So before Fargo season one came out, he was making a round saying, don't expect this to be a straightforward adaptation of the Coen brothers film, but we're existing in the same universe. We're doing our own thing. And he did exactly that in the run-up to Legion. He and the producers were going around saying, listen, if you're a Marvel fanboy and you're waiting for optic blasts and costumes, this isn't your show. We're doing something different. It's more art. He didn't say it quite that condescendingly, but pretty close.
Yeah.
He said it pretty close.
Yeah.
And, ultimately, what he's doing is he's doing the same thing. He's entering an existing universe and playing with it. I think anytime this show focuses on Dan Stevens, who's doing some very squirrely, wiry performing there, I'm in with the show.
Before we go on, give me the rundown.
Sure.
of kind of who this guy is and what his situation is.
All right. We meet Dan Stevens playing a character named David Haller, who is in a mental institution, who believes that he has an advanced form of schizophrenia. And there is a lot of playing, especially in the opening couple episodes, about what is reality, what is his fantasy, what is happening now, what happens in the past. There's a lot of fracturing of the narrative timeline.
Yeah.
I think it's visually inventive. I think it's narratively less inventive. It's still intriguing, still makes me want to kind of keep watching.
Mm-hmm.
But on a plot level, we're at a disadvantage because we know more than the character does.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always a bit of, impatiently waiting for him to kind of clue in.
Sure.
As would happen with any superhero narrative. Here, because everything's so fractured, it takes even longer. It's a more laborious process. And if you have spent any time with any kind of superhero narrative in the last 10, 20 years,
right,
you will have seen the superhero narrative, call it what you will, deconstructed, dissected, fractured in exactly
right.
The way this show is
bent,
doing.
Bent in this manner.
Exactly, yeah. This way. And I don't believe that the show understands that it's doing something that has been done a lot elsewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
This whole thing about he has to unlock his power, we're going to explore your memory by going inside your memory, which is also
right.
Familiar. It's a familiar trope. And it's got Jean Smart. When Jean Smart shows up, I'm like, okay, great. And then she plays basically female Professor X.
Sure.
Professor XX,
sure.
I guess is what you call her. And there's always this moment when they kind of do anything that is conventionally superhero storytelling. I get that internalized nerd phobia I had in Civil War when we watch Robert Redford, the great actor Robert Redford, say, Hail Hydra. And you're like, oh,
yeah.
Oh, I think you're lowering yourself.
I see what you mean. Now, Alan, you have written about this show already over at Up Rocks. Can you talk a little bit about your kind of your basic take on Legion?
Well, the character is relatively obscure, even among comic fans, even among X-Men fans, and I don't even know how much ultimately the show is going to wind up leaning on what's in the comics, because the character is related to a famous X-Man, but I don't know that they're going to be allowed to do that, or even if they want to do that.
Right.
So it seems like Hawley is doing his own thing. I was excited for this, like Glenn, more because of Hawley than because of the source material, and to me it really lived up to it. It's really dazzling. That first episode especially, the one that's already aired, was just a delight of the senses, the way it looked, the way he sort of pieced every image together, and he plunges us into this world and the worldview of the main character so that you, like him, aren't entirely sure what's real and what isn't. So even though we're seeing occasionally bits that seem to give us more information than he has, you're not even sure how much you can trust those. And a lot of the times it drives me crazy when TV shows set themselves up in this way, where they want you to just sort of analyze everything frame by frame,
right,
pixel by pixel, to figure out what's real and what isn't. But this was done, I thought, so gracefully and so beautifully in both the direction and the cinematography and the art direction, but also just in the performances by Dan Stevens and by Rachel Keller, who he also brought over from Fargo, that I was all in on this immediately. I loved it.
Yeah. What do you think makes the difference between kind of a fractured narrative that bothers you and a fractured narrative like this that works for you?
I think it comes down to whether or not there's anything beyond the fractured narrative.
Okay.
You know, I complained all the time about, for instance, Westworld as existing only as a puzzle to solve.
Mm-hmm.
And the audience solved it months ahead of time, and then there was nothing else left. Whereas this, I feel like even if we sort of, by the end of the first episode, you kind of have an idea of what's real and what isn't, maybe. But I still liked this character, and
yeah,
I liked the love story between him and Sid, played by Rachel Keller, and some of the other things, what Aubrey Plaza is doing as the best friend, etc., that I didn't care. It was just so well executed and had more substance, ultimately, than just, you know, what does this mean? What does that mean?
Right, right. How about you, Thompson? What'd you think?
Yeah, I was up and down on this show from the beginning. And I think it's interesting. We've talked about superhero origin stories, and we've talked about puzzle box mysteries and everything. To me, this feels like a slow motion origin story a little bit. And coming in as somebody who is not familiar with the source material, you have that first episode, which is visually dazzling, but it is deliberately taking you inside this guy's head. You can't tell what's real and what isn't. And I spent the whole episode sort of waiting for a few more puzzle pieces to come together. And I felt like the end of this, like, what, hour and a half episode, it sort of ends with go. They've finally sort of set in motion what the show is going to look like. And I found myself, as I watched the second and the third, I found myself wanting to go back and rewatch the first to get a clearer sense of what was going on. So, like, there are elements of it I found so interesting. I think visually it's gorgeous. There are what look like throwaway spectacular images, and you're like, my God, did they just set up that spectacular visual? And then they go back and reference it, and they've clearly put more thought into it. But at times, I've gotten a little impatient with it.
Yeah. I think I have two things about this show, one of which is sort of related to what you were just saying, which is you hear these directors and creators saying, you really need to think of my prestige cable 10 or 12 or 13 episode piece as a 12-hour movie. Right?
Oh, puke.
Oh, puke. Alan Sepinwall, up rocks. The thing is, it's not a 12-hour movie. It is structured and delivered in episodes. And to me, what Steven was talking about is a little bit of an issue I had with this show, where the pacing of the payoffs and the pacing of explanations is too far apart. And so, like Steven, by the time I felt like light was being cast on something, I had forgotten what it was. I feel like it actually would work better if you're really interested in the show and you really want to give it the best possible chance of working. You might be better off waiting for four episodes to air and then looking at them all at once. To me, to try to look at this one episode at a time was frustrating. And that is often how I take things in if I have the time. So I watched it and I felt like it would have worked better for me if it were more compact. just because it is so fractured, I wanted things to stick together better. And it's not just the fractured thing. It just depends on the complexity of the story. I actually used to feel the same way about The Wire, that The Wire only worked for me when I watched it four or five episodes at a time, because the density of the story meant that I would forget what had happened. By the time you learned more about it, I would have forgotten the premise. The other thing is I'm always a little bit squeamish about shows that mix up mental illness, superpowers, being a mutant, and kind of specialness, the kind of the general idea of specialness. Because when you look at this, I understand the ambiguity of, you know, does he have a mental illness or does he just have some kind of powers? Or is it both? But in the original, when you find him in the psychiatric hospital, he has friends, including the character played by Aubrey Plaza, who presumably is mentally ill. And then I feel like you're dealing with a mentally ill character in the context of a superhero show, and I'm not fully sure that they serve that character that well. Now, Alan, you said you liked what Aubrey Plaza did in this. I felt like she didn't have that much to do.
Yeah, I felt the same way.
What is your reaction to that character?
She doesn't have a ton, but she's sort of like, ever seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Yeah, yes. I'm laughing because this morning I said to Glenn that my thing about her is I feel like she's playing a little bit of a standard One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest psychiatric hospital character.
No, but,
so it's funny that you would say that.
But she strikes me as kind of the Nicholson guy, which is she's not there necessarily because she's mentally ill, but because she's there because it's an easier place to be than jail or something else. I don't know. And maybe we'll find out more about her as we go along. But just sort of, this is going to sound a little bit off topic, but it reminds me of my complaints about the Star Wars prequels, which is the Star Wars prequels needed a Han Solo character. It needs like someone commenting on what's happening.
Oh, that's
otherwise
see
what you're saying.
Really heightened and really serious. And so in the midst of this sort of dramatic and arch and weird thing about whether David Haller is the most powerful mutant ever discovered or if he's just profoundly mentally ill or both.
Right.
You've got Aubrey Plaza wandering around sort of with this wry look on her face, just doing sarcastic commentary on everything that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And it really leavens a lot of what's happening, so it doesn't seem quite as pretentious as I think it could otherwise come across as.
Interesting.
Yeah, I'm very, very mixed on that character. I love Aubrey Plaza. She feels both underutilized and, when she is utilized, frustrating.
Yeah.
She's there not only to provide sarcastic commentary and to provide a little bit of, as you said, Alan, a leavening agent, but she's also there to speak in riddles and kind of further muddy what you're seeing.
Mm-hmm,
and so she feels more like a device than a character.
At times. How about you, Glenn?
I trust this guy. The whole notion of does he have superpowers or is he mentally ill is not new territory. The show thinks it is. It's not.
Right.
And, you know, there's an interesting piece in LA Weekly by Angelica Jade Bastian, which kind of tackles some of this stuff about, you know, defining the character as schizophrenic and everybody on the show saying, it's not true, you're not insane.
Yeah.
Which means that that's his only value.
Yeah.
There's some weirdness there, and I totally agree with it. I believe in this guy.
Yeah.
I believe in Noah Hawley, and I'm going to watch more. I just want something to come out in a left field. And I'm confident this show is built so that we'll do that.
Yeah. I want to ask one more thing, which is, Alan, where do you fit this show into the greater universe of kind of current TV comic book adaptations? You have your ones on Netflix that are kind of the dark and gritty, right? The Daredevil and Jessica Jones and Luke Cage and that stuff. You have the CW Flash thing. Do you think this is similar to kind of the dark Daredevil-y stuff? Or do you think this is a whole different branch of comic book adaptations coming to television?
It's a new branch, certainly for TV and to an extent to movies. You know, both the CW shows from Berlanti and the Netflix shows all feel factory produced on some level. And they can be very good and at times border on great. But they're still like, you can tell that they're a product of multiple big corporations coming together and having lots of meetings and focus grouping things to death and figuring it out.
Yeah.
Whereas this, because it's such an obscure character and it's being done off on FX and was handed to Hawley, it feels much more like, we don't really know what to do with this. We have no expectations for it. We have no other plans for the character. do whatever the hell you want, Noah. Right. Have fun.
Right.
And so he's not making, and I don't want to sound condescending about this because I love comic books and I love comic book shows, but he's trying to do something a little bit better than just a comic book show.
I think that's how he sees it for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting what you say about kind of that the characters available, because I think that's sort of how Guardians of the Galaxy came to be. And that worked out to me. So
worked out all right.
All right. Well, I will be curious to hear what those of you who watch Legion think of it. So come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet at us at PCHH. When we come back, nature photography takes a leap forward in BBC America's Planet Earth 2. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Showtime. Billions, the epic power struggle between two New York titans who will stop at nothing to take each other down. Set in the high-powered world of finance, it's a game of big egos, big money, and big stakes. Billions returns Sunday, February 19th at 10, 9 central, only on Showtime. Catch up on the first season now. Download the Showtime app now to start your free trial.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Check out the Ask Me Another podcast for hilarious puzzles, word games, and trivia. Test your odd food knowledge with Kat Cora, stage superhero fights with Wyatt Cenac, and roll a 20-sided die with David Harbour from Stranger Things. Ask Me Another is your favorite game night, but a whole lot funnier. Play along now on the NPR One app or at npr.org/podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. In 2006, the BBC's Planet Earth represented a remarkable leap forward in nature photography, and now Planet Earth 2 arrives. And while the first Planet Earth had its U.S. airing on Discovery, where David Attenborough was replaced by Sigourney Weaver as narrator, Planet Earth 2 airs on BBC America beginning February 18th, and Attenborough's voice remains. Shot in 40 countries over 3 years, this sounds a lot like the intro to The Amazing Race.
It really does.
The six-hour follow-up soars and creeps through the world and simply watches. Now, this is one, you know, we have not done a lot of nature documentaries here on Pop Culture Happy Hour, but I got the screeners. I watched some of them with some of my loved ones, and I thought it was so much fun that I wanted other people to watch it. And therefore, we are going to sit here and watch about Planet Earth. Let's talk about Planet Earth 2 coming to BBC America now.
I love how you sobered up at the end of that sentence.
Alan, when you and I talked about this, you sort of were saying, well, I was on the fence. I wasn't sure if I was going to watch it. And then you gave me some updates about how your viewing went. We should say this is divided into six parts. They explore islands, mountains, jungles, deserts, grasslands, and cities. And then there's also a making of special that I highly recommend.
Yep.
So, Alan, how did your viewing of this go?
So I put it on and I'm watching it, and about 30 seconds and I go, dude. And then another 30 seconds pass, dude. And another 30 seconds, dude. It's just, it's really, you know, you turn into Bill and Ted at a certain point. It's so stunning. The photography, how close they're able to get, and the imagery they're able to capture of what the animals are up to. There's a thing in the first episode where a lizard is running away from snakes.
Nope, nope. No thanks. Nope.
Okay, so this is, there was a viral, I think it's fair to say, a viral clip that went around earlier, or I guess late last fall, that was basically a baby iguana type thing running away from a group of snakes.
Yeah, yeah. Not, it's a horror movie.
Not a snake, but a bunch of snakes.
They are called racer snakes.
If you saw that clip, it's from this, and the segment is longer. Yeah.
My daughter always objects to any attempts to show her documentaries in any form.
Yeah.
And she would wander into the living room and see something, and suddenly even she sat down with her jaw slack at what she was seeing.
Yeah. And I think we should say that the structure of this is basically, and this was not necessarily the structure of the original Planet Earth. It seems to be something that they really focused on here. It is a series of vignettes about animals. So you go into one animal or kind of animal, and you follow them them for, you know, maybe 4 or 5 minutes, something like that. And then you go to another animal. And so what you get is, you know, some of them are really focused on, you know, a hunting predatory animal. Some of them are a silly animal. Glenn, you didn't like the racer snakes.
Nope.
Talk to me about how you felt.
Well, I mean, everybody's talking about how gorgeous and exquisite the photography is. It's been 10 years since the first series, and in that time, drone technology, for example, has really allowed them to go and shoot in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's fantastic. And a note that they used to sound in this series about how threatened these habitats are has become, in the intervening 10 years, a major theme.
Mm-hmm.
That is constantly, it's a dominant leitmotif, I guess. That said, the anthropomorphizing in this series is really frustrating to me. And I tried to write down any moment that the narration was imputing human emotions, traits, motivations onto the animals, and I had to stop because it's everything out of David Attenborough's every last thing.
Yeah, I thought about that, and that actually wasn't my impression, because I think what they attribute to the animals is basically a desire to reproduce and protect babies, which I think they really have.
Of course.
A desire not to die, which I think they really have. And a desire to eat and get food.
And to
be kind of inventive in figuring out how to do those things.
I am talking about the acute adjectives that are assigned to these creatures. It got such that I wanted to watch it without the sound on, but if I did that, I would miss something we haven't talked about yet, which I think we need to, the sound mixing and the sound editing.
Yeah.
These microphones are picking up. I mean, there's a moment where the ibexes are scrambling over the side of a mountain, and you hear every crumbling rock. It is just fantastic. I wanted to turn it off when the racer snakes started hissing.
This is Glenn's inner Indiana Jones coming
People
out.
Tried to send me that snake footage, and I was like, I do not want to see snakes doing anything snakily, and you're a bad person for trying to make me watch it. And I'm not going to call it a fear. It's a pitched antipathy. It's kind of a fear. It's a biological imperative. It's only right. They are snakes. We are mammals. We used to live in the trees. When we did, they came for us. And it's the sight of a snake does fire off our fight or flight response. And in my case, I'm always fighting. I will never fight. And part of this is informed by a childhood spent watching the Chuck Jones cartoon Rikki Tikki Tavi one too many times, in which I heard this sequence in my nightmares.
Son of the man that killed Meg, if you move, I strike. And if you do not move, I strike. Oh, foolish people.
Okay, right there. Goosebumps, right here. Now, Stephen, do you recognize that voice?
Oh, is that June Foray?
That is June Foray. That is Rocky the Flying Squirrel. That is Witch Hazel. And she is the stuff of nightmares to me because of that. So anyway, that was, I didn't mind it in this. I found I could get through it even though there's too many of them. There's too many of these snakes
in
one
place.
Too many
snakes, yeah.
Because it was reptile on reptile violence. They were chasing an iguana.
That's true.
If it was like a marmot or something, I'd be.
Yeah. And you're like, I'm not a marine iguana.
I'm not a marine iguana. Rarely. I thought it was gorgeous. I just wanted the cuteness thing turned down a little bit.
Interesting. How about you, Thompson?
I was all in. I just love this show. Each episode is an anthology not just of animals and not just of locations. It is an anthology of stories.
Mm-hmm.
And so the marine iguanas getting chased by the snakes is a horror movie. And I'm sure, Glenn, you would object. With the sloth trying to get its mate, that's a romance.
Yeah,
there's thrillers and drama. And you're seeing animals, for people who've seen Planet Earth, they know what I'm talking about. You're just seeing animals you've never seen before, doing things you've never seen them do before in ways that are just thrilling to watch. And Alan mentioned watching this show with his kids. I was watching it in a living room by myself. And about halfway through the first episode I was watching, my son came downstairs and he was like, I'm just going to make myself lunch. And he just kind of slips off into the kitchen and I'm just watching more. And 20 minutes pass.
Yeah.
I pause it and get up. And I'm like, oh, geez, buddy, I didn't know. How was your lunch? He's like, I didn't start making it. He was standing in the doorway, transfixed for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And I think you mentioned, Linda, watching this show with loved ones. This is a perfect show to watch with loved ones because it's the world.
Yeah. And The thing that I want to stress also, we've talked about the storytelling, which I think is wonderful. We've talked about Attenborough, who, you know, I think Glenn is right that there is a kind of cutesiness to it. I don't disagree. But there is also an enormous amount of humor in it. And particularly the second episode of this, which is the one set in the mountains, contains both a sequence involving bears and a sequence involving flamingos.
Yes.
Both of which I thought were so funny that they were as good as most kind of cheap physical comedy that you can see on television.
Totally true. That episode also contains my actual nightmare, the nightmare I have most frequently. I am essentially an ibex. They have to navigate the tiny little footholds on the side of a cliff. And like that is probably my actual worst fear is to be this animal. It is incredible.
And the bear is like my favorite thing in the whole series. The bear just scratching its back against the tree, looking for all the world like a live action version of Baloo from Jungle
Book.
Absolutely true.
Sure. And I just want to say that moment and the moment with the flamingos would have worked without the music, without the cute music. Mm. Didn't need the cute music.
Oh, I think it does. I think the cute music is hilarious.
I look, here's why I don't. It sounds like I begrudge this series for doing that. I don't. Because what is this? What is the purpose of this? It is to create in viewers an empathy, an understanding, and a sense of urgency. So to do that, we tell these tidy little stories when actually real life is a lot messier than what is being served up here, because that's what storytelling is. We take the world, which is complex, and we reduce it down to a little beginning, middle, and end, and that's fine. I don't begrudge it, because that's what it's meant to do. It's meant to be shared with people of all ages so that they can kind of share a collective feeling that we need to do something.
I would push back on that a little tiny bit about the tidiness for the simple reason that I think very often in this show, you are encouraged to understand the plight of both the predator and the prey, that it's not just, you know, big, mean, bad lion wants to catch poor little baby, whatever it is. You understand, they talk about the lion needing to feed, that the lion will die if this hunt is not successful. But at the same time, you're watching this kind of traditional idea of like the animal trying to get away from being threatened. And I do feel like there is some kind of appropriate circle of life stuff that explains some of that.
Do you find yourself choosing sides? Is it a cuteness greater than scaliness?
Well, they keep going back to lemurs over and over again, and nothing's going to beat a lemur for cuteness. So, I mean, yeah.
You're always on the side of the lemur.
You're always on the side of the lemur, but I don't think it's that good versus evil, good guy versus bad guy, evil predator versus innocent prey, because that narrative has been, since Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, that's not new to nature documentaries. That's their bread and butter. What is kind of new is this. We have these three kinds of stories we tell. We have the mating ritual. We have the sanctuary comes at a cost. We get that. And we get another kind of story over and over and over again. And that's fine. Again, I'm not. It sounds like I'm dissing it. I'm not. I love it. But I just think it's doing good work. So that's one reason I like it.
Well, again, I personally would highly recommend gather your loved ones, gather your anthropomorphized dogs and cats, and watch Planet Earth 2 on BBC America beginning February 18th. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Missing Richard Simmons, a new podcast that follows filmmaker Dan Taberski's search for fitness guru Richard Simmons. It's 3 years since Simmons disappeared, and Dan Taberski wants to know why. He talks to regulars from Simmons' exercise class, as well as fans, former friends, and celebrities to better understand who Simmons is and what happened to him. Subscribe now to Missing Richard Simmons on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
Well, we have just finished gathering entries, NPR Music has, for our third annual Tiny Desk Contest. And each year we send out a call, have your band or yourself perform a song behind a desk, send us a video, and the winner gets to come in, perform a Tiny Desk concert, and go on a little tour, and enjoy the exposure that comes with that. This is the third year. Last year, the winner was a woman named Galen Lee, who is wonderful. Her YouTube video of her actual Tiny Desk concert just over the weekend passed 1 million views. And the winner 2 years ago, a guy who performs under the name Fantastic Negrito, just won a Grammy.
Yup.
And I don't usually strut around at things that happen at the Grammy Awards.
Tiny Desk.
The awesome power of the Tiny Desk really came through, frankly, throughout the night. There were a bunch of Tiny Desk veterans performing.
Adele?
Besides Adele, you had William Bell, who had a wonderful performance at the Grammys. It was a really good evening for the Tiny Desk. And having Fantastic Negrito, who is a wonderful performer and just an incredibly charismatic guy, if you read up on that guy's story, like, that guy had given up on music, had gone through some really low points, like he'd gotten in a car accident, wasn't sure if he could ever play again. He has this kind of triumphant return where he wins the Tiny Desk contest. And if you're me, you think, like, well, that's cool. That's a nice bit of exposure. You don't necessarily think that that means he gets a record deal and a Grammy Award.
Nice.
So Fantastic Negrito winning a Grammy, making me very happy this week.
Congratulations to all Tiny Desk veterans, and thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
It's actually a poem that loomed large in my childhood, and which I've had occasion over this last weekend to revisit and look at it through the eyes of an adult and find something that I never found there before. May I read it?
You may.
Okay. Go back through the tormentor and through the arch, and the second great hall you'll discover. Shun green if you can, but night's good color is for those of great valor. If shades of red stand for blood, the wise will not need sacrifice aught but a loop of magical metal. You're well along your march. Two pits along the way will be found to lead to a fortuitous fall, so check the wall. These keys and those are most important of all, and beware of trembling hands and what will maul. If you find the false, you find the true, and into the columned hall you'll come. And there, the throne that's key and keyed, the iron men of visage grim do more than meet the viewer's eye. You've left and left and found my tomb, and now your soul will die. That, as I do not need to tell you, Linda Holmes, is the riddle poem of the Demi-Lich Asarak from the D&D module The Tomb of Horrors, which was first published in 1978. It is an infamous campaign module because it is notoriously impossible. It's full of death traps, and, you know, if you were a DM and your players were getting a little cocky, you would put them through the Tomb of Horrors and they would die horrible deaths, every one of them, because it's not about a hack and slash dungeon. It's all traps and things that they have to detect, and it was just, you know, next to impossible. And that poem is something that the adventurers discover pretty early on in the campaign, and it's supposed to give them hints on how to get past some of the traps. And I looked at this with fresh eyes this last weekend. And when I was a kid, I memorized it because I took several characters through the Tomb of Horrors and never got anywhere because I just would die horribly because this poem and its riddle eluded me. So I memorized it. And it was very difficult to memorize, and I couldn't figure out why until I looked at it again. It's crap, this poem. This is just, it's like the meter is janked all to hell. And the rhyme scheme is not merely erratic. It is deranged. I mean, it just kind of comes and goes. Say what you will about J.R.R. Tolkien.
Oh, I will.
That man knew how a poem works. So the One Ring poem worked, has meter and rhyme. It scans in both the black speech and in Westron.
Okay.
Did it in two languages. This guy can't even do it in one.
I feel like I'm getting farther away from
it. I'm getting farther away from it by the second.
I'm just saying.
Why is this making you happy?
What's making me happy is that you revisit something from childhood that you meant a great deal to you, and the fact that it doesn't mean a damn thing because it is impenetrable and terrible poetry, that's an insight. It's an insight I gained.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
I like it.
He brought it all together at the end.
Yep.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Alan Sepinwall, what is making you happy this week? Beat that.
I'm going to try hard. I'll see what I can do. We are nearing, or possibly past, because comic book publication covers are always confusing to me, the 25th anniversary of the creation of my favorite current comic book character, the unbeatable Squirrel Girl.
Yay.
From Marvel. She is currently starring in a book called The Unbeatable Squirrel Girl by Ryan North and Erica Henderson. She was originally created in the early 90s basically as a joke character, co-created by Steve Ditko, of all people, the man who co-created Spider-Man. And she has the powers of a squirrel, including a prehensile tail, and she can talk to squirrels. And she appeared one time in a team-up with Iron Man where she beat Dr. Doom because she had her squirrel friends crawl inside his armor, and was destined to never, ever appear again. And then years and years later, another writer named Ann Slott thought, hey, wouldn't it be funny if we brought her back? And if she could beat Dr. Doom in her first appearance, maybe she can beat everyone. And so every appearance Squirrel Girl has made since then, no one can stop her. No one can beat her. She is super enthusiastic and upbeat. She is also a computer science major in college and a feminist. And she often wins fights just by talking to the other person and empathizing with them and understanding where they're coming from.
Imagine
and the
that.
Book, yes, the book by Northan Henderson is delightful. It's funny. It's sweet. My kids love it. I love it. I read it like before they're even home because I can't wait to get through it. And now somehow she is still around after 25 years. And there are like major actresses like Anna Kendrick saying that they really wish that there would be a live action version so they could play her because she is just that awesome.
Wow. Alan Sepinwall, the unbeatable Squirrel Girl.
Cosign.
Thank you very much, buddy. That's a good pick. I got a couple things. First of all, I want to thank our listener, Sarah, who wore our olive pin on Jeopardy.
That was awesome.
That was amazing. Seeing a screenshot of somebody on Jeopardy wearing our little olive pin made my heart so happy. So thank you, Sarah. Also, just recently, Hulu has the Golden Girls. Now, Glenn Weldon has made his dislike of the Golden Girls, which I consider to be
heresy
and wrong, known in the past. But I enjoy the Golden Girls very much. And if you are ever looking for a break from the dark, cringy comedy, and you want a different kind of cringy comedy, I encourage you to seek out the Golden Girls on Hulu. It makes me so happy, and not just because of this.
Thank you for being a friend. Travel down the road and back again. Your heart is true. You're a pal and a confidant. Dun, dun, dun. If you threw a party.
All right. My point.
It's my nightmare. Bring back the snakes.
My point is the Golden Girls are on Hulu. And finally, a couple weeks ago, I mentioned a very, very incisive book that I was reading that is called Ghetto Side. I finished that book. I am now reading another really incisive and often depressing book called Evicted, which is by Matthew Desmond, also recommended to me by a lot of the same smart people who recommended Ghetto Side to me. Such a good book. Again, I'm listening to the audiobook. Could not be enjoying it intellectually more, even though it's very upsetting. It follows a bunch of renters in Milwaukee, renters and landlords, through kind of how evictions work and why people get evicted and why cycles of people getting evicted and then evicted again and why people get in the hole. And it's really, really a terrific book, although depressing. So I've got Thank You to a Listener, I've got Golden Girls, and I've got a really, really good book that is upsetting but essential. And those things are all making me happy to read and listen and watch this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon. And you can follow Alan at Sepinwall. That's Sepinwall. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Alan Sepinwall, for being with us in our fourth chair. And thanks to all of you for listening. And we will see you right back here next week.